Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Hey, Bruce. How you doing, man?
Hey, David. How are you tonight?
Bruce, I'm good. I've been dealing with a computer, the new computer the last 3 months. It was so buggy. It was driving me crazy. So today I went and got a secondhand computer, and it's fantastic. Problem Mac? Solved. Yeah, a little Mac. A MacBook Air.
Mac guy the whole time.
And I'm not even blaming anything except for myself. Like, when you switch from Mac to some other kind of, maybe it was me the whole, I figured 3 months. After the first month, I think, like, why am I even, like, worried? Like, I'll figure this out. But I didn't. And 3 months was enough. So here we go. Bruce, 5-1 victory. Oilers victory over the Las Vegas Golden Knights. Started out as a pretty lifeless, tepid game, I'm going to say. Not much going on. Two teams that seem to be playing out the string, even though Vegas is still playing for its playoff life. They didn't have much. And neither did the Oilers to start, but they came on and poured it on. You were there.
I was there. Still got my hat on, David. I got hat hair, and it's just so bad that I just thought, no. I mean, you're still working on bad hair day number zero, but for me, some days the hat is the savior. This is one of those days. Anyway, I was there, and last game of my four-game mini pack for the year, and three wins now, and pretty decent performance overall. It wasn't like a thrilling game, but it was fairly satisfying. I mean, beating down the Vegas Golden Knights 5-1, you know, defending Stanley Cup champs. What's not to like?
Bruce, I'm actually on no hair day 1000. since I decided to take it down to the pavement, as they say. I like that expression. I think that's really funny. Bruce, this is our two good things, two bad things, two numbers podcast with one conundrum. What is your good thing?
Yeah, I'm going to go tonight with the young fella, Dylan Holloway. He kept catching my eye in a good way and doing good things. First thing that he did to catch my eye in a good thing was when he pasted the dastardly Braden McNabb into the board down at my end.
Sweet.
And that's a good way to, you know, get a quick path into my heart. Braden McNabb, he's a good, hard player. I think, wasn't he Kings? And then Vegas got him in the draft. Remember him injuring Nuge 1 year with a heavy, hard hit. And, you know, he just plays a hard game. And he wasn't hurt or anything. He just was on the receiving end. And that was a nice start. But Holloway, like, he was skating well. He was skating with purpose. He wasn't just sort of flying around with nothing being accomplished. I thought he had a good role to play in the Ekholm goal that you're going to talk about, where he mucked around in the front of the net and sort of created the lane that the pass came through behind, and possibly even a little bit of a screen. And he had a couple of shots on net, three hits, block shot, and finally a goal in the third period when he just he was too fast for Aiden Hill, of all people, who came out to field a puck and leave it behind his own net. And the only guy that was on it was Dylan Holloway before any Vegas defender could get close to it. And he just did the right thing, went right around the net and powered it in on the wraparound on the other side. And it was about 1 second between turnover and goal. And he seemed a little more directional tonight. And, you know, it seemed like he had purpose to what he was doing and where he was going. And his speed was a constant factor for the good. And I didn't see any sort of defensive blunders. And maybe you did. I mean, you scored the game, and I didn't score.
I don't think. There was one.
I didn't score along with you like usual. So, I, you know, I'm I'm kind of in the dark on some of that stuff.
That a cross-seam pass at one point led to a grade A shot, but that was it. Okay. Yeah, Bruce, it's going to be interesting to see where he ends up with the Oilers. You know, he has such obvious talent, you know, with size, he's fast, he's aggressive, he's got some skill, but not enough skill yet where he's scored regularly at the NHL level. In fact, his level of NHL scoring is really mediocre. Cool. And yeah, it's brutal. And his defensive play hasn't been great either. So I know the Oilers have slow cooked him, but part of it has been injury, right? Like he's been injured a lot. Part of it is he's trying to break into a Stanley Cup championship, you know, quality team that's at least trying to win the Stanley Cup. It's a contender, Stanley Cup contender. Right. Yeah. And that's hard to do, especially when the GM knows or believes that you need a lot of graybeards on the team. So that's held up Broberg, who's been behind Ekholm and Kulak, who've been brought in. It's held up Holloway, who's been behind players like, you know, Fogel, Kane, Henry, just an endless Perry, Hyman, list of players that have been brought in to play forward. So, but you know, both of them have also had, despite their obvious talent and assets as players, that they've struggled at times. So yes. It's going to be interesting to see if he can find a role in the playoffs. And I don't know if we're going to see him much in the playoffs unless the Oilers start to lose to a bigger, faster team. And when it becomes apparent, unless there's or injury, of course, but unless it becomes apparent that what the Oilers are using isn't working, I think we will see more veteran players in the lineup. And I'm actually, like, I know some people will find that harrowing. I will not. I think it's logical at this point. It's nice to see him, though, have a great game. And the goal he scored, usually I don't count, like usually in our system at least, and I'm more firm on this than you are, but I don't count wraparounds as grade A shots. Having done this now for 13, 14 years, wraparounds are hardly ever goals. Some players wrap it around. There's just hardly ever any goals that come off wraparound plays. This one though, I count it as a grade A because there was no goalie in that. How can a shot not be a grade A shot coming from inside the crease when there's no goalie in net? Like, so Hill was just so slow and Holloway was so fast. It was a combination of both. So a fantastic play by Dylan Holloway.
Well, the wraparounds, I mean, if they get the shot away from actually inside the blue paint, then it's a chance. So often they get it just to the icing line and they just try and shovel it across there. But if they come all the way out where they have an angle to stuff it in, it can be a pretty good chance. And I mean, especially if there's no goalie
Looks good, but I don't think
no goalie there. You're right.
If it's a goalie there, it's still just a 10 to 15% shot at best. And it is a grade A shot if they take it a little higher out towards the middle of the net. Okay. Yeah. That's a great A
shot. Get it into the blue paint and not just at the very edges of it.
Not at the edge of the paint. Yeah. So we've come to agree on this, I guess.
Well, I'm an old goalie, right? So I tend to credit saves and maybe overcredit them.
There you go. Bruce, my good thing is, you know, I've talked a lot on this podcast since the Vegas series about the Vegas zone and how hard it is to beat. And I thought, how do you beat the zone? Like how, because they just pack them in tight around the net. And if you rush at them, it doesn't work. So in some ways it takes away Connor McDavid, at least his best play, rushing in there, charging in and getting off, you know, going around players and getting a shot. Cause once he goes around one guy, there's another guy he's got to go around. And that's how they play it. So how do you beat that? And, you know, last year, I think I talked about in basketball, you beat it with outside shooting. And I think tonight the Oilers showed how you beat the zone. And it's with fast passing and a high shot from not from the blue line necessarily, but from the high slot. That's how you beat the zone. Because they leave the high slot open. You get as close as you can without being in the thicket of players, just on the edge, outer edge of that thicket. You pass the puck as rapidly as you can, and you move as rapidly you can around the outside of the thicket, moving the puck, passing the puck, without trying to penetrate it on the attack. And that kind of puck movement, followed by a shot from the high slot, will beat the zone, can beat this zone. And we saw it on the second and third Oilers goals. It was the first goal was the Eck hammer, now famous Eck hammer. Just some fantastic passing all around there. Corey Perry made a really nice pass. Evan Bouchard had won the puck initially, and he passed it to Perry. Perry made a really nice move at the blue line to get it over to Nuge, and Nuge went cross-seam to Ekholm. And Ekholm was pretty far out. He was at the dot. But he was open because they're all packed in there, right? And Nuge passed it across the top of the slot area. And that was open because they were all packed in there. They were a little disorganized. Maybe they would normally pick off that pass. I'm sure the zone, you know, if you're playing the zone properly, that pass isn't there. But you are going to get some good passes right at the edge of the zone. And he did that. And Ekholm hammered. He slammed that puck in the net. It was a brilliant slap shot. What a shot. The Eck hammer. And so that was the first one. The second one was a little different. The pucks, Hyman wins the puck on the boards. He gets it to Dreisaitl. Hyman goes to the net. Dreisaitl has the puck behind the net, and he finds Nugent Hopkins again in the high slot at the top of the circle. And Nugent Hopkins puts a quick shot at net. And I still don't know if it hit the net or it hit Hyman. It wasn't a grade A shot. It was pretty far out, but it caused some confusion. And once that outside shot happens, you crash the net for the rebound.
Right.
And that's what Hyman did. So you get the outside shot and you crash the net. And that's how you beat the zone. Because they're not playing man-to-man. And when you're not playing man-to-man, it's a little harder to pick up players sometimes in the slot. You're not right with them. They're not, you know, you're kind of protecting an area, protecting passes. And Hyman was wide open. So I think this is, it might have just been by chance, Bruce, that they happened upon two goals like this back-to-back, actually within less than 3 minutes. But this is how you can do it. It is like in basketball. You beat the zone by rapid passing on the outside, setting up for the best shot you can get, and then you crash the boards for the rebound in basketball and stuff it in. And that's exactly what the Oilers did here. You'll either score on the out, you can have a good outside shot, and then crash try to get the rebound. So
or screen.
Yeah, maybe they're onto something, Bruce. It would be interesting to see with McDavid in the game, because he wasn't in the game.
Right.
You know, they don't have their main guy who tries to penetrate the zone. But he, you know, he's pretty good at skating around the outside of the zone area himself, although he tends to skate it rather than pass it. And I think that passing it might be this rapid puck movement around the edge of the zone is absolutely critical in breaking it down and getting off a good shot. So...
yeah, well, those certainly were the two sort of highlight goals for the Oilers. I mean, Dreisaitl on his only shot of the game, but that was a 5-on-3. Great pass from Nuge and an executioner shot for a finish, but you're not going to get 5-on-3s every game. CeCe's was just a favorable bounce, if not an outright mistake by the defensive player who appeared to kick it in. And Holloway's, of course, was a big mistake by the goaltender and the Vegas defense. But the other two goals that you described were well-earned goals by the Oilers. And it was good play on both. Like I mentioned earlier, Holloway's involvement in the Ekholm goal, being that guy down low, and of course on the Hyman goal, it was Hyman himself who... I was creating a disturbance in front. In his case, he got a hold of the puck and slammed home the rebound. It was just his second goal in 7 games, and he was very happy to score it. It was a big fist pump from Zach because he'd been dry for a little while. And nice to break out of that for any player. And that made it 3-0 and really put Edmonton in charge of this game. Far apart were the two. They were just... two and a half minutes.
Correct. Yeah. 2.5, almost exactly. Your bad thing, Bruce.
Yeah. Well, it is the absence of McDavid, and the silver lining in terms of McDavid got a little bit of rest, and the team really responded to playing without him. But any kind of injury to the crown jewel of the franchise is always going to be a concern. And I have a particular shout out for mini pack number 8 holders, which I am one, because McDavid's now missed 2 home games this year, and both of them occurred on our watch. So the 4 games I went to this year, McDavid only played in 2 of them. And I was really saddened when I heard he was going to miss, because I thought assist number 100 is going to happen in this game, and I'm going to be there, was sort of the thought. But assist number 100 did not happen in this game. I frankly anticipate he won't be playing against Arizona on Friday, but there'd be a pretty good chance he'll be back in the lineup for the big game against Vancouver on Saturday. That first place in the division is still very much within reach. And last time I looked, Vancouver was trailing in the 3rd period. How's it going now? Score 3-2 with 4 minutes left. It was, and the Canucks are on the power play. It was 3-1 at one point. So we'll see how that winds up. But Michael Kesselring took a penalty with 3:54 left, and Vancouver's just starting a power play.
All right. We'll see. Bruce, I'm going to change my bad thing. I was going to say that the power play goal, the Oilers had the shorthanded goal by the other team, but the game was over by then. So it was a nothing play. My bad thing is I just wish we had seen more of Nugent Hopkins with Draisaitl this year, because I think that's a combination that really works. They've been struggling all year to find line mates for Leon Draisaitl, and this is as good as he's looked on a line to me, pretty much, other than when he's with McDavid. All year, he and Nugent Hopkins have meshed in the past. In 2019-20 that he won the MVP, Draisaitl. You know, that was the year, the famous dynamite line with him and Yamamoto and Nuge. And they just ate up the NHL for 30 games, 35 games, whatever they were together. And you can't say that Nugent Hopkins and Draisaitl have had tremendous success since that time. But it's something that I think they should have revisited. I see from natural stat trick after tonight's game, they've played together for 103 even 5-on-5 minutes. So it's not like they haven't played together. You know, that looks like 5 or 6 games where they've been line mates. I actually don't remember. It must have been earlier in the year. But I just think that is something, that's a line that could work. Now, maybe McDavid has a great preference for playing with Nugent Hopkins. I don't know. Or the coaches want Nugent Hopkins with McDavid. And let's face it, the Nugent Hopkins McDavid Hyman line was utterly fantastic for a big part of the year. They haven't been lately in the last 2 or 3 months. They've been a good, but not great. Before, they were just the best line in the NHL. They haven't been that. And I just wonder why we haven't seen more of Nugent Hopkins with Draisaitl. I think the possibility of Nugent Hopkins and Draisaitl, I don't want to say Kane, because I just don't think that works defensively. But, you know, maybe Nuge is enough of a cover player defensively, a smart defensive player to cover for them. If Leon decides to crank it up, if Kane decides to crank it up, could that work with maybe Fogel, McDavid, and Hyman in the top line? The line tonight of RNH, Hyman, and Draisaitl was fantastic. And, you know, I don't think you're going to separate McDavid and Hyman. That's not happening, right. Nor should it happen, because they just work so well together. Mm-hmm. But I think you might have something there with Nuge and Draisaitl. We've seen it in other years, and my bad thing is that we haven't seen enough of it this year to get a sense of who else might work with them and whether that would work between them.
Now, what generally seems to happen with those guys is that they switch out for each other. So if Nugent Hopkins is left wing with McDavid, then Draisaitl is center on the second line. And if Draisaitl gets moved up to McDavid's line, they never go with like the 3 of them on one line. So he gets moved up, and Nuge, who of course can also play center, moves back to play center on the second line. So they're crisscrossing, they're changing positions, changing lines, but it's like they're on opposite shifts, right? One of them's working the day shift and one of them's working the night shift. And you know, they see each other checking in, checking out at the same time on line changes, and don't spend a lot of time in sort of permanent, you know, or temporary, you know, for that game, full-time line mates. It just doesn't happen a whole lot. And I do sort of understand why the coaches play it like that, but it would be nice to, you know, as a change of pace to put Nuge and Dry together, because they have had sustained success at times in the past. And of course, they're very comfortable with each other on the power play. That's it's not like they don't know one another. They've got plenty of time together in various manpower situations to make it work. So it's a nice option that is too rarely utilized. I agree with you on that.
Nuge set up the executioner shot tonight, as well as setting up the Eck hammer.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, was McLeod who set that up, and Nuge set up the Hyman goal.
Oh, got that wrong.
McLeod who made that great crossing pass to Ekholm with Holloway in front.
I shall correct that right now. All right, there you go. It was his line. You're right. Holloway, McLeod, and Perry were out there. So fair enough, Bruce.
McLeod was named first star tonight, David. He had two primary assists on the first two goals, and pretty good game. Man, he can skate, that guy.
He can skate.
Seeing him live, it just stands out that much more when you have one guy who's just faster than the rest on both teams, it seemed like.
I remember in the COVID year when they didn't play the first half of the year and we saw him all the time in Europe. Mm-hmm. Did he ever look good on that big ice? Oh, he was just smoking up and down the ice. And I thought, oh, whoa, maybe there's a player here. Because he wasn't drafted that high, you know, I think about 40th overall or something like that. So, you know, it's most of those picks don't pan out.
Right.
But he appears to be doing so, that's for sure. Number, Bruce. What is your numero?
Yeah. Well, I got two numbers, but they're very related. They're 12 minutes and 12 seconds, and they're 21 minutes and 11 seconds. And that is the entire range of ice time for the 18 Edmonton Oilers skaters tonight. The D-men were all packed between just under 18 minutes in the case of Kulak and Ekholm, who both were in the 1750s. And 21-11, that was Evan Bouchard. And all six defensemen played between 21 and 23 shifts. So they were just rolling them over the boards. And in part, there was no penalties by the Oilers, zero penalties. That could be a number in itself to sort of mess with the rolling of the lines or the rolling of the pairings. But even up front, you know, it was every forward between 16 and 21 shifts. There was four guys in the 12, just over 12 minute range, Janmark, and who had a really fine game to my eye, Brown, Carrick, and Holloway. And they were all at 12. There's guys at 14. And the highest was Drysdale at 19 minutes and 11 seconds. So again, a nice narrow range. They just rolled the lines. And it was working in this game, but I think it's a good strategy for them anyway, with this huge backlog of games that they're clearing off in the last days of the season. You don't want to be forcing some of these guys to, you know, be playing 24 minutes at forward or 27 at defense. Use all your guys that you got and roll the dice. You got a good team.
3-3 Vancouver and Coyotes.
Ah, crap.
Yeah. Now they'll get a loser point at least.
Yeah. They scored on that power play within 10 seconds. 12 seconds.
Yeah.
Kessler ain't wearing the goat horns tonight, is he?
It happens.
Of course, I didn't see the penalty interference.
Yeah.
Against Nils Höglander. It's probably a dive just by looking at this, just by looking at the game sheet.
Probably is a dive. Yeah, that's a good bet.
Oh, okay. 3-1 in the third seemed promising.
I have two numbers that aren't related. Actually, I have one number and then two numbers. The first one is 101. The Oilers have 101 points. So congratulations to the Oilers getting over 100 points this season. That's quite an accomplishment considering the start of the year. And, they're closing in on where they finished off in recent seasons. What did they get last year? 109?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
So, this is a pretty decent regular season. Considering the deficit, pretty decent season from the Oilers. Bruce, my other number is, there was no penalty kill for the Oilers tonight, so this number remains the same. Our former colleague, Jonathan Willis, who writes for The Athletic now and then, he sent out some stats. So over the last 25 games, the Oilers on the PK. And he reported this... Ekholm is even on the PK. Kulak minus 2, Dehaene minus 6, CC minus 7, and Nurse minus 15. And that's kind of an alarming number.
Yeah.
Now, we've talked about Nurse's post All-Star game slump. He went into a massive slump. And I think he's gradually been playing better and better. Give or take the odd horrible game against Dallas, he's been getting better. But Jonathan was arguing that Ekholm should be ahead of Nurse on the PK, and that and I just thought, well, I thought that's an interesting argument. That's an alarming stat, but it's a very small sample size. It's just 50 minutes of PK time, and it's also an on ice stat. So even though someone might be on the ice for a lot of goals against, doesn't necessarily mean that they're at fault on all those goals against. The numbers that I looked at, and it was just a horde of numbers. It was in three categories. You're looking at the whole season because you need to get as big a sample size as you can on the PK. Even in a full season, you only get 100 to 200 minutes, which is a very small sample size to judge an NHL player on. Yeah. So, but that's all you have. So you a full season, that's all you have. It's got to do essentially. So what I like to look at is, okay, how many goals were they on the ice for the whole year? Where do they rank on the team? You and I do our best to figure out who's at fault on the grade A shots against and the goals against on the PK. And again, for us, this is the hardest situation for us to grasp who actually is at fault, because you have to understand the systems that the Oilers are using. You have to try to understand that. And plus, the difference between making a good play and a bad play on the PK is infinitesimal. It's just a matter of one's, like, to do the job well, you have to judge properly when to attack a player and when to back off a player. And it's a split second decision, and it's a matter of inches whether they get, if you make the wrong decision, where they get the pass by you, if you're not close enough to close on them to block off their pass. It's just really hard to do our work in terms of figuring out who's at fault. But, we give it our best go. So I look at, again, on-ice goals against, just the total numbers, where do they rank? Then I look at, okay, who's at fault on the goals against? We've tried to determine this. And then we also try to determine who's at fault on the grade A shots against. So I think if you look at all three of those things, and the same players are showing up at the top of the list, that says something. And if the same players on all three categories are showing up at the bottom of the list, that says something. So when I did that work and I looked at who's at the top, consistently at the top in all those categories, who's consistently at the bottom. At the top, it was kind of surprising to me. At the very top, it was the best forward was Warren Fogle. And the best defenseman was Cody Ceci. And Fogle was quite a bit ahead of all the other forwards. CC was ahead of all the other defensemen, but the defensemen were fairly closely grouped in the end. Nurse and Dehaene were the lowest defensemen on that list. Kulak and Ekholm were just behind CC on the list. So I think that Jonathan's argument is actually fairly strong, that Ekholm is a more effective PK player than Nurse, but Nurse is not, is certainly not as bad as that minus 15 looks. I mean, when you look at that number, it's just like, whoa, he looks like this horrible defender on the PK, you know, the black hole of defense, you know, and he has, if you look at the whole year, that's not the case. He's not that far off from Ekholm's performance. And he's actually, I think, a touch better than Daharnay, who's had his actually, he's a good penalty killer, but he's had his struggles this year as well. And it's Cece, you know, the unsung, much maligned Cody Cece, who stands out from all the defensemen, is doing the best job. You know, the other forwards who are doing a good job are Janmark, McLeod, and then Ryan and Nugent Hopkins have struggled the most in all three categories for the forwards. And Brown is kind of in the middle. He's good in some categories, weaker in others. I might be missing someone else here. Henrik has done well. Carrick has done really poorly initially. So these are super small sample sizes, but so far Henrik has looked really good on the PK and Carrick has not looked good at all.
Carrick got slaughtered in the Ottawa game, 3 goals against in a minute 7, I think it was.
Yeah. So Henrik is a really solid addition, it looks like. You know, you might, if you had some people, there's one final point I'd like to make here is that some people say, well, isn't there a quality of competition issue here? Yes. If you're sent out for the first opening faceoff against the very top attackers, isn't that and it's probably not a coincidence that three of the players who rate the worst, Nurse, Ryan, and Nugent Hopkins, are out for that first faceoff all the time. That said, CeCe's also out there all the time for that first faceoff, and he ranks at the top of the defensemen. So take that for what it's worth. I guess Cody Cece, it speaks all the better for the way he's getting the job done. And but I think that those numbers are affected by that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to make that exact same point about Ryan and RNH always starting the PK, which means they're always starting in their own zone. And if they lose the face-off, they're under pressure right away, you know, so, you know, they don't get sort of any free seconds in there. And they're playing against the other team's first unit, whereas Fogle and to a lesser degree McLeod, they're almost always the third guys out in the rotation. They're coming on, you know, when the penalty kill's already, the first minute has already been killed off, and almost surely they come out with the puck. You know, it's been iced down and the other team is starting 200 feet away and probably their second unit is out there by then, which is, you know, so their task is not as onerous as the guys who start penalty kill. As for the D-men, when the pairings are the way they are right now, they've been going, they just keep Nurse and Cece together and then they put Ekholm and Daharnay together. But for that extended experiment where Daharnay and Nurse were playing together at even strength, they kept them together on the penalty kill and went with Ekholm and Cece. And you might find if you dig in into those games that maybe the Daharnay-Nurse pairing got particularly clobbered on the penalty kill.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised because they have some pretty bad numbers there. So Daharnay was in a worse slump than the Nurse after the All-Star break. And so was Cece. All three of those players really struggled. And all three of those players since that time have been trending up, playing better hockey, which is really good news because they need them to play well in the playoffs. It was interesting tonight, Bruce. Jamal Myers, Nurse made a play where he rushed in and he got caught up ice on I think it was Mantha then who rushed in and got a good shot on net.
Well, that was Mantha. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was Mantha.
He was fast. Yeah, he's big and fast.
I think it was Mantha. Anyway, and Jamal Myers was saying like his Nurse's risk reward is off there. And it was interesting because it's, you know, it's the kind of typical criticism that you and I have made for years. Like, you know, we say the good and the bad of the players, but it's not something you generally hear on TV about Nurse. There hasn't been a lot of critique of him. And I think, you know, it's warranted. And I don't know. Some of it, sure. Does it do any good? Does he hear that? Is he going to learn? Does it make, you know, he does have to change his game, and he's got to get a better sense of risk reward. I think Stephen. And it starts with some speculation from Elliot Friedman. And this is just speculation. He clearly framed it that way. It was his theory. He was pretty keen to talk about it. It was on his podcast. And so we all know that Kane and Perry had a big dust up on the bench, and they have since laughed it off and say, this is how Perry's line, brothers fight.
Brothers fight.
That was great. That was a great framing of that. Yes. And because it's exactly right. Anyone who's been a brother knows that. But Bruce,
Friedman's a great olive branch to Kane.
Yes.
To say that. I liked his choice of words there. Two words got right to the point.
Yeah, I agree. Both those things. So Friedman's theory is essentially this, that the Oilers leadership group, he didn't name any names, but, you know, realize that to win this year in the playoffs, they need the best out of Kane. They need him to be a monster aggressive player, and he can't make stupid plays. He can't make selfish plays. So they want to get on him. And they enlisted Perry to help out doing that. And so that's the theory. And so it's funny, the Oilers Nation did a story on it, and I, looking at some of the comments, people were freaking out, like, oh, how dare you suggest this? And this is garbage journalism, blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, I thought the complete opposite. I don't know whether Friedman has heard this from someone, or, you know, he actually knows this is happening. But the fact of the matter, Bruce, if this wasn't happening, I'd be shocked. In a functional group of players, a large group of players, of course the leadership group of the team is getting together to talk and strategize about how they can best get performance out of other players. It's just it goes without saying. Barry Stafford, the former trainer of the Oilers, described the captain and his assistants as the fist of the coach, essentially. And he called them the captain and his henchmen, and their job was to enforce what the coaches wanted on the ice, to enforce it as henchmen. And to think that that this wouldn't be going on, and that they wouldn't be, and it wouldn't just be on Kane, it might be on Nurse too, for his poor risk reward, and it might be on someone else, and it might be on Draisaitl, or it might even be on McDavid now and again. If there's proper accountability and leadership on the team, and we're seeing some pretty obvious examples of it right now, you know, in public, of course they're going to be going after each other to get things right and yelling at each other to get their heads out of their butt and get it right. I don't think it's any controversy at all. I think this is normal and admirable leadership within a team, NHL team structure.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure where Corey Perry fits in the leadership structure of the Oilers as being a relatively new guy. But you got to think he gets oodles of respect in that room. He sure gets it from the fan base. And he makes mistakes of his own too, but they're not generally by, you know, lack of effort or, you know, not thinking the game well. And he's one of those, you know, he's sort of E.F. Hutton, right? When he speaks, everybody listens. And yeah, he certainly spoke in no uncertain terms to Kane on Saturday night. You know, whether he was a hired gun to say, okay, Corey, you're the one, or just because it happened to be the situation, they were line mates, Perry was in a good position, and Kane ignored him and tried to make a weak pass, and it bounced off the net and went south from there. And Kane or Perry was probably pissed, and certainly looked like he was, and they had a frank exchange of views, and It went on a little bit long, like sort of in public like that. You kind of expect that to happen in the dressing room as opposed to on the bench on national TV. But
Kane is, he is no shrinking violet. I don't know what that means.
He can take it.
But he's going to give it back. So that's probably what happens. He was giving it back or just saying, like telling him whatever. So anyway, you know what, in terms of Corey Perry's role on the team, Bruce, if there was a Hollywood director wanting to cast a henchman in a movie and the Corey Perry walked in the room, he'd be like hired. He's got that look. He's got that cold-eyed, scruffy look of the henchman.
Yeah, he does have all of that.
Yeah, anyway.
Give you the glare anyway, and...
The whole thing on a certain level. Yeah, the whole thing on a certain level has been much ado about nothing, but we all like to talk about it. So there you go, including me. I like talking about it. So
to do about nothing is state of the internet many days.
Every day. So
people will make mountains out of molehills as a matter of course.
Indeed. Indeed.
But getting Kane sort of somewhere within the structure is crucial. Like he brings an important element Oilers are going to need, but it needs him, you know, doing more positive things than negative. He's one of these high event guys and he's going to make mistakes, and you know, you have to accept that. But when the mistakes start to outweigh the positive things, then that's what you can't accept.
Yeah. Well, he's got to make the safe play. Like he's got to get the proper risk reward. They all do.
One thing he's really good at, and I noticed it again tonight, at least twice, Kane. Mm-hmm. And it is this ability to get air under the puck. If you give him like a quarter of a second in his own zone and they're under pressure, he punts that thing out like way up by the clock and out. Like he doesn't mess around. He lobs it on out of there, scoops it out of there. And he's very effective with the stick when he decides to make that play. I haven't seen him flub one.
When he's in good health, Bruce, I'd be surprised if there's a stronger player on the Oilers than Evander Kane. They had that ESPN issue where they're all nude and they had Kane.
Oh, yeah.
Partially. His body is one. He's like a human muscle. Like he is so strong looking. I've never seen anyone like, he's just unbelievably powerful looking. And, you know, yeah, that ability probably comes from that incredible strength. So, yeah, no, and this is why he can take on anyone. This is why he carries himself the way he does. Like, there's no one in the NHL who bothers, like, he's intimidated by. No one. Not the coaches, not the other players. So, I think if you're going to strategize about Evander Kane, you got to think hard about it because has become evidently alienated, and he's alienated his other teammates and become alienated on those teams. That can't happen. For them to win, they need him onside doing what he needs to do as a player. So they have to think about, okay, how can you achieve that? And I'm not sure, you know, necessarily that Perry had the best strategy for doing that, but it was one way of doing it. Maybe that is it. Maybe that is to have another hard man of hockey, get right in his face and eyeball to eyeball and go at it. Maybe that will work.
Perry he might be the best man to the task as opposed to, you know, one of the leadership group dressing him down. So that's for strongest guy in the order. The name that I hear from time to time from people who are a little bit in the know is Cody Ceci, apparently is an absolute hard rock of a strong guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't look weak on the ice. He just doesn't hit very much.
He's not a hitter. He's just,
You know, he's pretty good at covering the front of the net and winning those battles in front of the net. No, he doesn't often. I really do hope that Cody Ceci, he has been booted around as much as any player on the Oilers this year. I really hope he redeems himself in the playoffs. You know, it looks like they're go. It's with Cody Ceci now. So, like, you know, you can get over your fantasies of bringing, like I had, of bringing in another defenseman. He's the guy. So I'm rooting for him. And he can get the job done. He can do it. And so can Nurse. and they can do it in tandem against tough competition. They've just got to bring their A game defensively and not worry about anything else. I think that's the key. As Jamal Meyer said tonight on the broadcast, to his credit. So, all righty, Bruce. Any other thoughts?
Oilers have now locked Vegas out. They're 9 points ahead, and Vegas has 4 games left. So Edmonton will finish ahead of Vegas Golden Knights, the defending Stanley Cup champions. And wait a minute, what do I see here? Arizona 4.
Nice.
Vancouver 3.
So Vancouver has 5 points. 4 points ahead of the Oilers. The Oilers have 2 games in hand.
And a game left against Vancouver.
Yeah. Now,
the odd point does help Vancouver because they have the tiebreaker. So if they do finish tied, they get it. So, but Logan Cooley scored in OT from Dylan Gunther and Sean Durzi. There you go.
Cooley.
Couple good young players on that scoring play.
Yeah.
Cooley and Gunther.
Guess they might be heading to Salt Lake.
So we see them next. Vancouver doesn't play again until Saturday. Edmonton plays Arizona on Friday and then Vancouver on Saturday. So this is part of the nice schedule that the Oilers have been dealt. And I spent 2 posts whining about, so I won't spend any time here. But it's a factor, and they're going to have to work with it and around it.
All righty. Bruce, thanks for talking tonight.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.